Today is Thursday, September 7th. We're going to work on EKG and some cardiac information and then spend time on review. Okay. Why don't we just talk through the basics of an EKG and then we'll label one together. Just want to talk about the electrocardiogram as it relates to a measurement of heart activity. We can abbreviate the electrocardiogram as ECG or EKG. And what it's doing is it's measuring the movement of ions into and out of your muscle cells. So when we're thinking about, muscle contractions, it doesn't directly measure that. It just simply measures the influx of sodium that comes with depolarization and the outflow that occurs with repolarization. That is what actually shows up as these peaks and valleys and waves on an EKG. All right, so this is what we would think of as a picture-perfect sinus rhythm. This is what we would hope to see. But I do want to mention that when we hook up a person to an EKG, any movement that the person does can also show up in the read. So if somebody is moving his or her arms and legs about, that can show up and interfere with the measurement of the heart's activity. So anytime you see upward spikes on the EKG, what we're looking at are nerve impulses that cause muscles to depolarize, and the wave of depolarization is coming toward the electrodes. Okay, so going back to BIO-210 for just a moment, what ions are flooding into those muscle cells during depolarization? Sodium, good. So sodium's flooding in, and that wave is coming toward an electrode for an upward spike. If you happen to see downward spikes or downward waves on those EKGs, what we assume then is that the wave of depolarization is heading away from the electrode. So what I want to dispel is a myth that any upward spikes are depolarization and downward spikes are repolarization. That's in fact not the case. Those waves or spikes on an EKG just simply tell us in what direction the wave is traveling relative to the electrodes. I think it did. Did you get it?
I got her in the picture.
Uh-oh.
I don't know. I think because it's just light.
I can hit the lights.
Okay.
That might help. Nowadays we're modern, we use computers to record electrocardiograms. We of course can do this on paper as well. Back before modern computers, most EKGs were run through paper strips. And so what you're looking at here is basically the paper setup for an electrocardiogram. The blocks on here mean something because the paper moves through the recording device at a certain speed. The small, teeny tiny blocks on here, you'll notice they're moving at a speed of 0.04 seconds. That's not really what we're going to focus on. What we're going to instead focus on is highlighted. It's one large square moves at a speed of 0.2 seconds. So this larger block that's got a little more color to it, that one is about 0.2 seconds. So if you count from the very far left here, you've got, that is your 0, 0.2 seconds, 0.4, 0.6, 0.8, and that's one full second. So that is going to tell us kind of how quickly this heart rate is passing through this paper. Every big box on here is about 0.2 seconds. I don't know if you can see, but I wrote on the board that one cardiac cycle is equivalent to 0.8 seconds. So this is what we would consider an ideal scenario for an EKG. It's the perfect sinus rhythm that we would expect to see. Assuming the cardiac cycle is 0.8 seconds, then we're going to assume around a 70 or 75 beat per minute heart rate. In this picture, you're looking at an isoelectric line. It's kind of what they think of as the 0 millivolt line. And it's not always drawn on an electrocardiogram, but it's the point at which deflections that come above are toward the electrodes, and deflections that come below are coming away from the electrodes. But nonetheless, they've marked it on here. It's not really marked on that previous picture, the one that you guys have in your course pack. Okay, so I just want to review a little bit of 210 material before we get into all the business about the waves on the electrocardiogram. Back in Bio-210, when you guys studied depolarization, we look at having sodium ions come flooding into the cell. And that influx of sodium ions will depolarize the cell. We know that depolarization is not a guarantee of action potential unless you reach what?
Threshold.
Right. So depolarization is not a guarantee of an action potential unless you reach threshold. So in this picture, what you have is sodium rushing in. That leads to depolarization. And we should see the muscle cells and the heart tissue contract once we get to that point of threshold. All right, so we know that after the contraction event takes place, we need to repolarize those cells and reset them for another go-around. So during repolarization, what ions leave first?
Potassium.
Yeah, potassium ions leave first. And then what do we finally do to restore all those ions back to their resting state? Yes, sodium potassium pump takes the ions that have left, those potassiums that exited, and moves them back into the interior of your cell, and then moves sodiums back to the exterior of your cell. This is not an even exchange. You know, of course, it relies on having the 2-for-3 ratio here of ions movement. But once you finish this process, we can then fire another impulse and start back over with depolarization once again. Ashley?
You said repolarization, the potassium leaves first?
Potassium leaves first, that's right.
And it's 3 sodiums and 2 potassiums, right?
3 sodiums and 2 potassiums, correct.
Do we have to still know the millivolts?
Not on this, no. That's good news, right?
Yeah.
Don't have to dig back in your brain. Okay. So but now we kind of got a little review with our terminology here, depolarization, repolarization. What I'd like to do is make sure that we have an opportunity to label the EKG. This one's already labeled with the waves, P, Q, R, S, T, and there's even a U wave on this particular EKG. But I want to put some notes on here as to what's happening before and after these waves. So you're welcome to draw on that particular picture. I'm going to hit the light for just a moment. I've got one on the board. We can label that one too. This will be a great way for us to review what we did in here on Tuesday. Okay, on Tuesday we talked about the cardiac conduction system. We know that conduction system or intrinsic system is built into the muscle tissue of our heart. Do you remember what pacemaker starts the whole pace of depolarization? SA node. Good. So when the SA node fires, that's going to start off a cardiac cycle. You'll notice that this initial nerve impulse of an SA node fire comes before your P wave. So when the SA node fires, we send a nerve impulse across the walls of our 2 atria. Those 2 atria are going to start to depolarize, and then they'll contract. Keep in mind, this electrocardiogram is only going to measure the depolarization and repolarization events, not the actual contraction events. So when we see this P wave here, what chambers specifically are depolarizing?
Atria.
Good. So P wave tells us the atria depolarize. Okay, that means the atria are getting ready to contract. Not yet there, but they're getting ready. So when we talk about the intrinsic conduction system, we know the SA node fires first. That sends a nerve impulse across the walls of your atria. They contract. The nerve impulse has reached now the AV node, which sits down at the bottom of your right atrium. When that AV node fires an impulse, it comes right after the P wave, but before we see that QRS complex of waves. So that's going to be our next event here. AV node now fires an impulse.
That's between the P and the Q wave?
Yeah, put it between the P and the Q. So you see a pretty big spike that follows the firing of the AV node. What we assume now is that the nerve impulse has traveled from your AV node through the bundle of His, we also call it a junction, down the bundle branches and up through the Purkinje fibers. When those Purkinje fibers release acetylcholine, what chambers now begin to depolarize?
Ventricles.
So you'll see a pretty large depolarization. It's a pretty large depolarization event for those ventricles because there's a lot more myocardium in the walls of the ventricles than there is in those atria. So there's a question on the bottom of your worksheet that says, why is the QRS wave so much bigger than the P wave? It has to do with the amount of muscle mass in your ventricles. There's more muscle mass in your ventricles. Of the cardiac cycle with the firing of the SA node. When the SA node sends out a nerve impulse, that nerve impulse depolarizes your atria, and we see that with a P wave. Keep in mind, depolarization is not yet contraction. The atria actually contract at a point behind these QRS waves, so you're not going to truly see a wave representing atrial contraction. Why don't we make a note here as well that behind the QRS wave, we have atrial contraction and atrial repolarization. I'm just going to make a note that it's hidden. Okay, so hidden behind your QRS wave, atria contract and atria depolarize, or sorry, repolarize. So that QRS wave truly represents what the ventricles are doing. It doesn't really represent the atrial contraction or the repolarization event. All right, and so there's another wave here that follows QRS. We know that the ventricles depolarize during QRS, and then the contraction event must occur somewhere between the S and the T wave. Then the T wave represents ventricular repolarization, meaning what is happening?
Oh, it's going back to a polarized state.
Yeah, going back to a polarized state, so it's resetting. Okay, so we actually don't have a wave here to represent ventricular contraction. We just know that it occurs sometime between the S and this following T wave. So let's hit this from the top. The beginning of the cardiac cycle is when the SA node fires an impulse, and we see a resulting wave on the EKG known as a P wave. Good. And what specifically is happening to your atria at this point? They're depolarizing. Good. Does that mean they're contracting?
No.
Not quite yet, right? So when do atria actually contract? Yeah, hidden behind a QRS wave. Good. And so they also repolarize back there, so there's not a wave representing them. That QRS wave actually represents something else. So when the SA node fires, the atria depolarize, the nerve impulse reaches the AV node. AV node now sends a message down a bundle of His, bundle branches, Purkinje fibers, and we now depolarize your ventricles. What wave now shows up? QRS wave, good. And about the time that they begin to depolarize, your atria are contracting. That's going to help to force blood in your atria down into the two ventricles. I should mention that atrial contraction is not entirely necessary. Gravity does a pretty good job of pulling blood down into your ventricles. So all the atrial contraction does is just kind of finish the job that gravity starts by pushing any remaining blood in the ventricles, or sorry, in the atria down into the ventricles. So that's really the issue here, is that we want to get those ventricles to fill with blood so when they do contract, they can do a pretty good job at ejecting blood out into circulation. We actually don't have a wave for ventricular contraction. It would occur between the end of the S here and this T wave. So we assume that's where the ventricles actually contract. And then finally, once the ventricles have contracted, they repolarize, meaning they're doing what?
Resting.
Yeah, going back to normal, they're going back to their resting state. And so that's the T wave. Now, on this picture, you might notice there's a U wave, and I just wanted to mention that you're not responsible for knowing it, but the papillary muscles, those little finger-like muscles inside the ventricles, will also repolarize and may in fact show up as a U wave. Okay, but you don't have to know that one. I just wanted to mention it since they do have it on this picture here.
Because I'm late from the beginning,
okay.
Can I just happen to go over it just real quick?
Okay.
All right, so the beginning of it starts with a nerve impulse. What's the SA node?
Pacemaker in the right atrium.
Yes. The sinoatrium?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so then that starts, and then that's when you see the P wave that comes after that, because that's the atria starting to depolarize.
Correct.
So that's the atria.
That's right.
And they're not contracting at this point, but they're starting to.
Right.
Okay, and then the next one, I remember the AV node, that fires an impulse. That's like right there at the bottom of the atrium,
mm-hmm.
and then between the atrium and the ventricle. And then that one fires off, and then that's when the QRS peaks. Is that what it's called? Is it
yeah.
called a wave as well? The QRS
they call it a wave or a complex of waves. Yeah.
Okay. And at that point, maybe two or three things are happening, like the ventricles are depolarizing. Behind that, the atrial are repolarized? Like they're going back to repolarize?
Yeah, they contract during
that. They contract
that.
First, and then they go to it.
Then they repolarize.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the T wave is this when the ventricles are depolarizing.
That's right. And then you're done, because now you're back to the beginning. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. If you want to measure the rate here, like the heart rate, they don't do it from P wave to P wave because those don't always show up reliably, and they're not really the event that causes the blood to be ejected from the heart. Which wave is the one that represents, you know, we probably are going to get blood ejected from the heart? QRS, yeah. So, in fact, if they want to measure the heart rate, what they do is they look for these peaks of the R waves, and they'll measure from one peak to the next R wave peak, and that is going to be the distance between your two R waves. If we look at our EKG paper and we say, okay, every big box is 0.2 seconds, then we should count around 0.8 seconds between successive R waves.
I
So I'd like to share with you some abnormal looking EKGs. We'll do those on page 41. That really is dim with the lights on, isn't it? Just checking to see if anybody needs the board before I cut the lights back off. The QRS wave is bigger than the P wave because the ventricles have more muscle mass. That's one of those questions. Let me see what the other one is. Is that it? Yeah. It's just the muscle mass in the ventricles leads to a bigger QRS wave. So if you want to practice these abnormal EKGs, I do want to tell you about a really another cool website. You know, if you played the Nobel Prize website for blood typing, they also have one for EKGs. So pretty cool. They let you hook up the leads for the electrodes. They guide you through to take an EKG, and then they ask you to interpret it. So it's a pretty cool way to kind of study up on this stuff if you're interested in learning a little bit more about how this works. Okay, so our first one up there on the very top of page 41 shows a really big problem called a systole, otherwise known as a flat line. What's going on with the electrical activity of the heart?
There is none.
There is none, right. So the pacemaker, the SA node, is unable to initiate a response, you know, that allows for the atria to contract and the ventricles to follow suit. So in this case, what can we do for someone? What's that?
Provide
electrostimulants.
CPR.
CPR.
Okay, so if you do CPR, you're basically manually pumping heart, or rather pumping blood through the heart. Epinephrine can also be a way to kind of stimulate that SA node to initiate its control back over the heart once again. And in order for those paddles to work, we actually have to have some kind of electrical signals running through the heart, right? So those electrical signals are not present in a person who has asystole. So they would be ineffective against, you know, some kind of heart problem like this one. The brain dies within about 5 minutes when there's no oxygen. CPR does at least allow for us to help try to circulate that oxygen to the brain and other organs and tissues. Let's see, our next condition here, which is a serious condition, is called third-degree heart block. And at first glance, this looks fairly normal. You've got some QRS waves up here. You've got some P waves up here. But I want you to take a moment and count with me. How much time passes for each big block? 0.2. Yep, 0.2 seconds. And the normal cardiac cycle is how long? 0.8. Okay. So this R peak right here is where we're going to start our counting, and this R peak is where we're going to finish our counting. So if we start here at 0, there's 0.2, 0.4, 0.6, 0.8, there's 1 second. 0.2, 0.4, 0.6, 0.8, there's 2 seconds. I'm just going to estimate 3, about 4, almost 5 full seconds between R peaks. And anytime you see those QRS waves and those R peaks sticking up, what are you assuming is happening in the heart? Ventricles are depolarizing, and what should happen immediately next? They contract, right. So here you've got P waves, P wave, P wave, P wave, P wave, boom, QRS wave. This kind of reminds me of an engine that's trying to turn over and it's sputtering. You've got P wave firing at what looks to be a pretty normal timing mechanism. But because there is a block, thus the name heart block, between the SA node and the AV node, we're unable to get the message from the SA node, the pacemaker, down there to the AV node. So this means that the ventricles are not getting the message to contract in a timely manner. So unfortunately, that means that the ventricles create their own rhythm, and they fire at a much slower pace than what we see with the atria. Unfortunately, 4 to 5 seconds between successive heartbeats means that the blood is sitting in the ventricles and it has time to do what?
Clot,
yep. So unfortunately, this can lead to other issues if the heart is not ejecting blood at a fast enough pace. Another life-threatening condition is called ventricular tachycardia, or VTAC.
That's when you shock someone.
That's when you shock someone, yep.
Yeah.
What about the heart rate here?
Too rapid,
yeah, it's very fast. Can you estimate for me the timing between R intervals? About 0.4 seconds, yeah, because if you pick any one of these, it's sitting on a line, that's 0, then 0.2, 0.4. Normal cardiac cycle is about how long? 0.8. So we're going twice as fast as normal. If normal heart rate is 75 beats per minute, can you estimate for me a heart rate? 150, yeah, because we're going twice as fast. So in this case, the ventricles are trying to contract so quickly that we're not able to adequately eject oxygenated blood out into circulation. So what happens to vital organs like your brain? They don't get enough oxygen, right. So yeah, this is certainly the one where you would want to get the rhythm back into control, where the SA node is exerting its force over that pace, that rhythm. What can happen here is sometimes people have had heart damage, maybe through a heart attack, and perhaps another piece of nodal tissue kind of sets up and is a major player in setting a pace faster. There can be other issues like epinephrine or other kinds of chemicals or drugs or stimulants in the system that can set the heart rate faster than its normal, 75 beats per minute. This is worst case scenario. If you don't control VTAC, it drifts into this even worse condition called VFib, or ventricular fibrillation. So can you find any P, QRS, or T waves? No. What happens with fibrillation? Yeah, they're kind of quivering, right? So there's no coordination here with contractions. The muscle cells are twitching and quivering, and unfortunately there is no routine way of moving blood from atria to ventricles and then back out through the heart. Okay, so shock for that, yeah. These are listed as non-life-threatening, and I don't mean to imply that they're not severe, and I don't mean to imply that they can't cause major harm in a person. I mean to imply that by not being life-threatening is, at this very moment that a person has atrial flutter or AFib, this person may be completely asymptomatic and have no idea what's going on. They can live for weeks and months without any kind of symptoms from these kinds of heart arrhythmias. And, until they go in for an EKG, they may not be diagnosed with one of these conditions. This particular condition shows what looks to be upside down QRS waves. This may simply be the fact of where the electrodes were placed on the body. But these look like quivery peaks, don't they? These are P waves. And you can see what looks to be a flutter going up to them. They describe flutter as the heart looking like a bag full of earthworms, something that's uncoordinated and just kind of writhing in place. And of course, again, we're looking at problems with making sure that the P wave, or the SA node rather, stays in full control over the AV node. This can lead into something called atrial fibrillation, and everything about AFib is irregular. So for starters, let's take and look at some of the distances between the R intervals. All right, so let's just take this one. Let's say that's 0 seconds. There's 0.2, 0.4, 0.6. Okay, 0.6 seconds between those two peaks. Then we have 0, 0.2, 0.4, 0.6, 0.8. Okay, that looks okay. And then we've got 0.2, 0.4, 0.6, 0.8, 1, almost 1.2 seconds later. So we have not had a heartbeat yet that is the same pace from the previous heartbeat. Also, you'll notice that the patterns here are irregular. We've got a lot of clutter here between the successive R waves. You'll notice it says that the atria quiver rather than contracting. And this can also come from having a piece of nodal tissue in the atria that thinks it's going to be the pacemaker. So it kind of can take control away from the SA node and say, hey, I'm running the show here, but I'm not doing a very good job at running the show. What do you think is a problem for somebody who has AFib? By having irregular contractions. What are you giving the blood and the ventricles time to do? Clot, yeah. So this person may be asymptomatic. They may not know they have this condition, or how might they feel? Lightheaded. They may feel palpitations. They may feel flutters in their chest.
Is that like the same thing as a heart murmur?
Heart murmur is kind of a catch-all term. It's often used for valve issues, but not necessarily so much this.
And what if, like with heart palpitations, what would that look like on the EKG?
That's just kind of a really generic term, and it could be anything from this to premature contractions. I have heart palpitations, something called premature atrial contractions and premature ventricular contractions. Mm-hmm. So you may see waves piling up on top of each other. It would take somebody who can interpret the EKG to figure out exactly what's causing the palpitations. Yep. So in the case of AFib, someone may have had a history of heart problems. Maybe they had a heart attack before. And by having a heart attack, it may have damaged the SA node's ability to stay in control. So this, may be non-life-threatening at this very moment, but if we don't do some kind of medication to prevent, blood clots from being formed, or some way to maintain a more normal heart rate, then we can see things that are much more serious arise out of AFib. Okay, so you're probably looking at this page going, oh gosh, what do I have to know about this page? I'm not going to ask you to describe these particular abnormalities. Just be able to identify them as what they are come test time. And keep in mind, this is not until test number 2, whenever that is, sometime in early October at this point. So just kind of put that on the shelf in your brain and come back to it when you're studying for test number 2. All right. Do you guys have a lot of questions for the test that's supposed to be on Tuesday? We could, yeah. I was thinking if you want to stop here, we can just not continue further with this content. Because it's probably going to be a while before we have a test on this. I don't want you to forget it. So we can put a note that we're going to pick up with cardiac cycle and diastole and systole later, and then we can just open the floor for test questions. That sound like a plan? Okay. Taylor, you wanted to do hormones? Any particular ones, or
just what's going to be on the test?
Just do hormones, okay. Okay, so kind of just hitting the highlights from the very beginning of endocrine. Are you comfortable with the difference between a hormone and a neurotransmitter? Okay, bloodstream for hormones, neurotransmitters communicate to other cells directly. Okay, how about the difference between amino acid-based hormones and steroid hormones and how they communicate with their target cells?
Oh, are you asking if we're good on that?
Yeah, we can go over it too.
Okay, yeah. The protein is secondary messenger, right?
Protein is secondary messenger, yeah.
And the other one is the
direct gene, yeah. Yeah, so some things to just kind of jog your memory when we talked about protein-based hormones. The protein hormone itself is the first messenger. Inside the cell, we turn on a chemical that serves as our second messenger. It is called what? CAMP. Good. And then CAMP helps us to activate an enzyme. That enzyme is known as? Yeah, good. Protein kinase. It's got an ASE ending. That's a great reminder. Okay. By contrast, our steroid hormones, and oddly enough, thyroxine, works by a direct gene activation mechanism. And in this mechanism, we actually use hormones inside the cell to talk to our DNA. And so what do we turn on using that hormone and receptor interaction? We turn on protein synthesis. Okay, so that's kind of a key thing to keep straight here, is that steroid hormones activate protein synthesis, whereas secondary messenger systems work with turning on CAMP and protein kinases to help speed up chemical reactions. How about permissiveness, synergism, antagonism? Any questions on those? Good. How about the different kinds of stimuli, hormonal, humoral, or neural? Any questions on those terms?
Would you give an example for that on the test, or are you just going to ask us if that has scenarios?
I would probably ask you, I might give you a description, and I might say if a hormone is stimulated by a blood concentration, what kind of stimulation is it? So I'd give you a, yeah, if it's blood, humoral. And I may say to you that, say, insulin is stimulated by blood glucose concentrations, which is just another way to ask you the same question. All right, so here's where we really get down to the nitty-gritty, right? The hypothalamus and the pituitary relationship. So why don't we talk about the releasing and inhibiting hormones that control the anterior pituitary. So the releasing and inhibiting hormones made by the hypothalamus travel next door to the anterior pituitary, and they stimulate or they shut down production of the hormone. So we've got growth hormone, releasing hormone, and inhibiting hormone. We've got all sorts of things here with thyroid, corticotropic. We've even got hormones that ultimately control what the gonads are doing. So the general rule of thumb we talked about, where are releasing and inhibiting hormones made? Hypothalamus, good. And they always target your
anterior pituitary.
And if you want to increase production of hormones by your anterior pituitary, should you choose a releasing hormone or an inhibiting hormone? Releasing, right. And what do inhibiting hormones do?
Stop
production. Good. So we know that the hypothalamus also makes two hormones, ADH and oxytocin, but they travel down and are stored in what?
Posterior.
Good. And they are both neurally controlled, for that matter, because it's your nervous system that promotes their release into the bloodstream. All right, so let's talk about the anterior pituitary one more time. This time we're going to focus on what it makes. The anterior pituitary makes its own stimulating hormones. Sometimes they're called tropic hormones, yeah. All right, so what hormone from the hypothalamus activates the release of growth hormone from the anterior pituitary?
GHRH,
good.
Growth releasing hormone.
Good, growth hormone, releasing hormone. What is the action of growth hormone? Good. Stimulates bones and muscles to grow. Good. And if we have excess as an adult after our epithelial plates have closed, we have a condition now known as?
Acromegaly.
Good. If a child has too little growth hormone, it stunts the growth and causes a condition known as? Pituitary dwarfism. That's right. Let's see. We've also got up here thyroid stimulating hormone. What is the target of TSH?
Thyroid.
Yeah, makes it release thyroxine and triiodothyronine. And if you want to increase production of TSH, what hormone comes from the hypothalamus? If you want to increase production of TSH, what hormone comes from the hypothalamus?
TRH.
Good. Okay. If you have too much thyroxine being produced, it's a negative feedback loop, and you'd in fact shut down TSH levels. We do have releasing hormones and inhibiting hormones for most of these. Let's see. What are the what is the target organ of ACTH? Good, adrenal cortex of the adrenal gland. And if ACTH talks to the adrenal cortex, it is a hormone that encourages production of aldosterone and what else? And one more?
Sex hormones.
Sex hormones. Good. Okay. Prolactin targets what?
The mammary glands.
Mammary glands. And in what type of population would we expect to see prolactin being active? Yeah, women who are breastfeeding their kids, you know, producing breast milk. For those who are not producing breast milk, what hypothalamic hormone should shut off prolactin? PIH. Yeah, prolactin inhibiting hormone. So for most people, PIH is in control. For only those who are breastfeeding, we should see PRH controlling prolactin. And then finally, the gonadotropins there, FSH and LH, ultimately target what part of a person's body? The gonads, good. They bring about two effects. They increase production of hormones, and what else? They make you produce egg if you're females or sperm if you're males. Yep, so those two hormones work together to bring about puberty, yeah, and make sure that you maintain sex cell production. Okay, let's see. Probably one of the bigger sticking points here are the adrenal glands. Let's go back and hit those. So the adrenal glands have two portions, an outer cortex and an inner medulla. The outer cortex produces steroid hormones such as aldosterone, cortisol or cortisone, and sex hormones. Now, of those three types of hormones, which one is the one that regulates blood pressure?
Aldosterone,
good. Now, of those three sets of hormones, which one helps to maintain long-term sugar metabolism?
Cortisol.
Good. Of those three, which one helps to maintain sodium and potassium levels in the bloodstream? Aldosterone. Right. Which one helps us to increase water reabsorption with sodium reabsorption?
Aldosterone.
Yeah. ADH is only water, that's right.
ADH also comes from hypothalamus.
That's right. That's right. Let's see. In terms of gluconeogenesis, or breaking down fats and proteins into usable sugar, now which hormone are we talking about?
Cortisol.
Good. And everybody, males and females, make small amounts of sex hormones in what portion of the adrenal gland? Good, zona reticularis, good. Okay. Let's talk disorders here, because that also has been a sticking point in the past. Okay. So looking at these three disorders, which of these three comes from a lack or not enough aldosterone and cortisol?
Addison's,
good. And which of these three diseases has, you know, an excess of fat production, weight gain, Cushing's, good. So for a person with Cushing's, they have excess levels of what hormone?
Cortisol,
good. Okay. And then which of these three diseases would you expect to have low blood pressure, muscle weakness, fatigue?
Addison's,
good. And for which of these three would you expect to see high blood sugar?
Cushing's,
good. And then finally, of course, masculinization comes from excess sex hormones in that deepest layer of the adrenal glands. Okay. How are you with, say, thyroid glands, parathyroid? Okay. Do you need a rundown on those? How about calcitonin versus parathyroid is regulating calcium levels? Pretty comfortable there?
Pancreas.
What's that?
Pancreas,
okay. All right, so pancreas has two roles in the body. It has an exocrine role that we'll talk about later with the digestive system. Right now, let's focus on how it plays a role in endocrine and hormone production. The Acini cells that we're going to talk about later, we'll leave alone for now. Let's focus on the islet cells that are part of the endocrine function of your pancreas. So in this picture, we're looking at cells that are considered to be islet in nature. They are classified further as being alpha cells or beta cells. All right. So which type of hormone is produced by an alpha cell? Glucagon. Good. And beta cells produce? Insulin. Would you consider these hormones to be synergist or antagonist?
Antagonist.
Good, good. So they're working against each other to control what?
Blood sugar.
Good. These are both regulated through negative feedback. If blood sugar is too high, which hormone is released by the pancreas?
Insulin.
Insulin, good. And of course, if it's too low, we respond with glucagon. Okay, I just want to make a point here that insulin's the only hormone we have, the only hormone we have that lowers blood sugar. If you're keeping track, we've actually talked about several that increase blood sugar. Here's glucagon. What's made by the adrenal glands that raise blood sugar?
Cortisol,
that's a second one. Growth hormone does it.
Epinephrine
does it. Gosh, that's four so far, right? Okay, so there's certainly no problem getting blood sugar to increase. What we're having difficulty with is getting the blood sugar down. So insulin is the only one to do that. Let's see, there's actually a form of diabetes associated with lack of insulin. If you are type 1, what does that mean?
That means you rely on insulin injections.
You rely on insulin.
Is it only when you're a kid that you have that?
It's life. It's, you're born with it, and then it's lifelong. Yeah.
But what should we do?
My best friend's dad got juvenile diabetes, and he was like 45 years old.
Wow. So it took that long to diagnose? Wow.
It happened. It's not. He's a very skinny little man, but I don't even know really how. He was older.
Well, I've heard even like teenagers, having not been ever diagnosed, finally get diagnosed and they realize, oh, well, that's what all the symptoms were. Crankiness and other things that you wouldn't necessarily say, oh, hey, that's diabetes. Strange. If you're type 2, you're not insulin dependent, but we look at that more as being diet, exercise, lifestyle related. But nonetheless, diabetes mellitus is different from diabetes insipidus. What symptom do they not share in common?
Polyphagia,
good. What two symptoms do they share in common? That's right, good. And speaking of diabetes insipidus, the problem with that particular hormone or that disease is lack of which hormone?
ADH,
good. And where's ADH released from? Yep. Posterior pituitary, good. And the reason that a person with diabetes insipidus will urinate frequently is because the actual job of ADH is to promote what?
Water
retention. Good, good. Just want to make a point here about ADH. It is only promoting water retention. It does not promote sodium retention. What other hormone coming from the adrenal gland does that? That's aldosterone. Good. Sure.
Is there any other disease that may have polyuria?
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at things like hypoaldosteronism or Addison's disease, they may have polyuria because they're not retaining water from lack of ADH, or lack of aldosterone. Trying to think if there's anything else. Mostly those hormones that have to do with water retention, if you alter aldosterone or ADH levels, there's where you get the polyuria. Yeah.
What is the treatment for diabetes
and insipidus? Give a drug called vasopressin. It's basically ADH, and it makes you retain water. Yeah. A student that I had about a year or so ago, she had her pituitary removed. They were having a real hard time regulating her vasopressin because she was constantly drinking and constantly peeing. So, yeah. I just wanted to mention also, I went past it back here,
often forgotten about is ANP or atrial natriuretic peptide. Let's see, I know it's coming up soon. There it is. Okay, so, you know, when we talk about aldosterone retaining water, you know, retaining sodium, increasing blood pressure, ANP was briefly mentioned in the bottom of one of those pages. It's, thank you, there you go. It's the only one to lower blood pressure. So it causes you to lose fluids and salt in your urine. It's probably, maybe manufacturing-wise, it may be easier to stop aldosterone than it is to increase that.
Okay.
And it may be side effects, too, of that. You know, the Lasix and diuretics basically do what that does, but it may be easier to control how much fluid a person loses through the other route. How are you guys doing with endocrine? Is this something that's still lingering out there, hard to get it to stick? It's coming along okay?
It's just a lot.
It is a lot, yeah. How about blood typing? Anything I can help you with there?
If
I
need to explain
the mother baby. Okay, the Rh stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Is that going to be on the test?
Yeah, there's some of that on there.
Yeah, I just mean like the mom who is Rh negative.
Yeah, that'll be on there. Okay, so in terms of transfusions or pregnancy, they work the same way. The issue is for Rh negative people. If you are Rh negative, the concern is for you getting an Rh positive baby if you're pregnant, or an Rh positive transfusion if you're receiving blood. We do not automatically form anti-Rh antibodies in our bloodstream. We only form them upon exposure. So for anyone who gets a transfusion of Rh positive blood, the first transfusion produces mild reactions. For a mom who is pregnant and is Rh negative, the first pregnancy with an Rh positive baby will produce mild, you know, amounts of antibodies. We do provide a drug called Rogam at twice during the pregnancy, once at 28 weeks and again at birth. And the job of Rogam is to suppress immune, you know, function, basically shut down the antibody formation. Okay, so the catch is, if you are not given the Rogam shot, you now have an army of antibodies built against that Rh factor. The second time you're pregnant and have an Rh positive baby, or the second time you are getting a transfusion of Rh positive blood, you now have an army of anti-Rh antibodies that form a much more severe reaction. So the second reaction and subsequent reactions are more severe because of this huge number of antibodies ready to fight. And moms who give birth to Rh-positive babies, this reaction between the antigen, the Rh antigen, and the mom's anti-Rh antibodies is called hemolytic disease of the newborn. And it's got a really fancy name as well. It's called erythroblastosis fetalis. So what happens to the baby's blood cells? Yeah, rupture them. Yeah, they can be born hypoxic, with not enough oxygen. They can be born with brain damage. So, you know, that's why nowadays, if we are aware that mom is Rh negative, we automatically give the Rogam shot at 28 weeks and again at birth, whether or not we know that baby is positive.
I was going to ask, how long would you have to do that as soon as you know you were pregnant?
They blood type you as soon as they know you're pregnant, and then if they know you're a negative person, they'll give you a shot at 28 and a birth. And even if you have negative baby after negative baby, they'll still do that. Yeah. 28 weeks, yeah. So I guess the baby's probably big enough at that point to produce enough antigens that mom is now becoming sensitized. So probably up until that point, there's probably lesser risk. So take home message, you know, for the very small number of women that are Rh negative, you know, Rh negative moms are the ones that have to be concerned about having Rogam shots to prevent anti-Rh antibody formation. Okay, positive moms, there's no issue there because, you know, if whether your baby's positive or negative, you're not going to fight what the baby has. How about other blood type questions? Anything with ABO?
Whole blood.
Okay. So if I am A positive and you want to give me B positive blood, and we're talking whole blood transfusion, what antibodies are found in the B positive plasma? Anti-A. So now you're giving me whole blood that contains not only a foreign antigen, B, but you're also giving an antibody that would fight my blood type as being foreign. So that is the issue there. You've got antigens to be concerned about, and then in whole blood, you've got to worry about those possible antibodies.
So if you were only giving blood cells, you could give any blood type, any blood cells, just as long as they weren't in the plasma?
If you're doing, say, B-positive cells to A-positive cells, then my antibodies, my anti-B antibodies would still fight.
Yeah.
When you're saying whole blood, you mean like the red blood cells, white blood cells, and the plasma?
Yeah. Yeah, take the whole thing. And sometimes they'll do just the plasma for like a burn patient. Some people need just the blood cells. Let's do another one. Let's say that we have AB positive. I'm AB positive, and you want to donate to me A positive blood. Okay, cell-wise, antigen-wise, compatible?
Yeah,
because if I'm AB positive and you're giving me A positive blood, nothing's foreign, right? Okay. But if we switch this up and say, okay, we've got an AB positive person and now you want to donate whole blood, what does the A positive person carry in the plasma? Anti-B antibodies, right. And that.
Say that
again.
If you give it, then you just have to be mindful of anti-B.
You could. I mean, you know, and they'll do that in emergency and worry about the consequences later. Yeah. So that's the only issue, that we just have to be mindful of those antibodies. How about other blood type questions? You guys good with erythrocytes, the various types of leukocytes, platelets, blood clotting?
Oh, let's go to the white blood cells.
Okay. I'm not going to ask you pictures on tests. That may help relieve you a little bit. Okay, so let's talk about the granulocytes for just a moment. We know that these love a particular color of stain. So we're going to start off with the neutrophils first. And they like a stain that is somewhat light colored, maybe light blue, maybe light pink. But probably what is more striking about them is their three-lobed nucleus. Neutrophils are eaters. They're phagocytes. So their job is to help clean up populations of bacteria. In fact, these are the most common types of white blood cells that we have. There's something like 70% of our population of white blood cells. Okay, so the only place you have to identify the picture is on your lab test. You don't have to worry about doing that in lecture. Let's see, the next type of granulocyte is called an eosinophil. These particular white blood cells are still granulocytes. Well, what do?
Good.
Fight allergies, they fight parasitic worms. So, you know, kind of a different function from what those neutrophils were doing. So if you were to have, say, hay fever in the spring, you wouldn't necessarily expect to have elevated levels of neutrophils, but boy, you'd probably expect to have high levels of eosinophils because of those allergies.
Question?
Sure.
I'm sorry. Do all white blood cells perform diapedesis?
All white blood cells do diapedesis, that's right. Yep. The last one is a basophil, and its job is to release histamine. It even contains heparin granules as well. But the histamine is the real issue here because that causes vessels to leak. And we seem to see this one when we have allergies. If you have itchy, watery eyes, sniffy, runny nose when you have allergies, thank you to the histamine from these basophil granules. Okay, and then of course the agranulocytes tend to lack visible granules. They may have a few here and there, but for the most part, there are no granules in these. The lymphocyte tends to have a really large nucleus, and its job is to make antibodies. Yeah, those are the same antibodies made against foreign blood types and those other antigens. So antibody formation is the job of a lymphocyte. And monocytes are what we call macrophages. They will travel by diapedesis often to a site of infection. Phagocytes, right? And as they get there, they eat. So they're also part of this cleanup team that help to remove debris, bacteria, and infection from our bodies. Let's see, of these five that we've talked about, which is the least common blood cell, or, you know, white blood cell?
Basophils.
And the most common?
Neutrophils,
good. And what are the two agranulocytes? Yeah, lymphocyte and monocyte. And the three granulocytes are?
Neutrophils,
basophils, eosinophils, good. So the phils are the ones with the granules, good. Okay, kind of what you wanted to hear? Okay. What's next? We've got a few minutes left. Sure. I would look at compatibility issues. If I say to you I am AB positive and you're going to transfuse, say, A positive to me, I may say to you that I'm just dealing with cells. I may say to you I'm dealing with whole blood. And so you want to evaluate, is this a good transfusion? Why? Or is it not so good, and why? So, in terms of cells, yeah. The only small issue you have to be aware of is if you're doing plasma, and then now you've got those antibodies in the plasma. That's one. I would look at diabetes insipidus, diabetes mellitus. Look at how they're different. Look at how they're similar. Sure. Who's got it? Difference in similarities, yeah. And then, very much so. Not insipidus and mellitus, it does. Right, yeah, insipidus is not going to, because there's no blood sugar issue with
blood sugar.
Why
do they use
they use it because it's anti-immune, it'll lower your immune response, and so basically that'll make your immune system less active and less hyper about that particular situation. Yeah, you would think, and then it turns around and raises your blood sugar.
Yeah. Are there going to be any
That disease problem we're talking about, that's one. But you're talking like stimuli. I'm not sure if I've got one on there for that. And maybe like the differences between hormones and humoral. I put that on there in the past. I'm trying to think what else is on there. Relate cortisol to diabetes, because if you've got mellitus, cortisol just makes your problem worse since it raises blood sugar. Okay, so I just want to repeat since, some people weren't here quite when we came in yet. If we are not here for Tuesday due to the hurricane, then if we come back Thursday, we'll have the test then. If it's next week, the following week, we'll do it then. I will post on B2L and send out emails, but whenever we come back, that first day will be our test day. That way we stay on track. If you guys need anything, feel free to email me. If you're home and, studying or whatever, feel free to email. Y'all stay safe during the storm.